Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for Three Women, Three Ways. We are the show that talks about current issues. I've been saying we're the show that talks about women's issues, but my daughter informs me that there are no such things as women's issues. There are human being issues. And so I guess I have to change my intro here. We talk about human interest things, and particularly centered around issues that impact women. How's that? And my name is Heather Stark. I'm here, we're well into our second year, almost to our third year of doing this program. And, of course, you know that all of our programs are accessible from the Internet, and you can get to those past issues and past shows and listen as much as you'd like. I'm going to throw out our phone number today, and I want you to write it down because this is a show that I don't want to keep interrupting a lot. I will, so that if you didn't get the phone number, you will get it. But this is a show that is extremely important. Our phone number is 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. And I have with me today Eric Merlino. He's the executive director of Contact Lifeline, and that is in Wilmington, Delaware. And the reason Eric is with us is because there was a story in the news this week. It's actually been going on for a few weeks. And it is about a man in Delaware who happens to be a very wealthy man because he is an heir to a large, large corporation. And he was charged with raping his 3-year-old daughter. He admitted to the court that he did this. The court found him guilty. So far, hallelujah, the court's found him guilty. He's going to get what he deserves. Problem is, the judge, the female judge who sentenced him, made a statement that he would not do well in jail, in prison. So instead of prison time, she gave him probation. My contention is that he gave his child a life sentence, and he gets probation. Now, I'm well aware that sometimes the media doesn't report everything. Maybe there's something going on here that I'm not aware of. But Eric's here so that we can chew this around a little bit. And Eric, welcome to us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Just one thought off the top of my head, just from your intro, not directly related to the case, but the statement that your daughter made is actually a very positive indication of the kind of thinking change that needs to happen in the culture, in that what have been considered women's issues or women's problems really are problems for humans, for everyone. I think sometimes say women's issues become ghettoized as, you know, and treated less seriously because they are quote-unquote women's issues.
I think you're right.
It gives me a lot of optimism to know that, you know, your daughter is someone who is already seeing the sociocultural ramifications at a young age in a different way. So I just wanted to say that off the top because that was striking to me.
Oh, well, thank you. She's a pretty bright girl and has a lot of insight into the world today, I think, so I'm proud of her. Let's get to this particular case, Eric. I mean, it's in your neck of the woods. You work with sexual assault, and let's lay a little bit of a background. Is incest common?
Incest is unfortunately very common, and even in the commonness, it is significantly underreported. I believe the statistics are around 46% of children who are raped are raped by victims of their perpetrators or family members. So that's a full 46%. That's nearly half. And then if you break it down a little further, 11% are raped by their father or stepfather.
That is huge, so huge. I don't think we really realize how often this occurs. In general, you know, sex abuse and rape, I think, you know, what were you saying off the air? It was like 1 in 5?
Yes, by the age of 18, 1 in 5 females have been sexually abused in some way by some person, and 1 in 20 males. And I think both figures are undercounted, underreported for all of the reasons that you would expect, and I think particularly the male abuse is probably underreported because of the greater. I think there's almost a greater taboo against talking, you know, men coming forth and talking about issues of sexual assault.
Yeah, and we also know that most sexual assaults are not even reported.
That's correct.
Is that
That's
right?
correct. It is the
yeah.
And when you say reported, there's a you know a tier of levels of reporting. You know, was it reported? First of all, was it reported to anyone? In other words, a friend, a family member. You know, and then the next level is, was it reported to child services or was it reported to the police? And all of those figures are. Of non-reporting are significantly high. I don't have the exact statistics, but they're well over 50% and probably higher.
Wow. Wow. And of those, I don't actually have the statistics in front of me. I wonder if you do. Of the ones that are reported, only a very tiny percent are actually prosecuted.
Yes.
And of those,
go ahead.
And of those prosecuted, an even tiny, tiny, tinier percent are found guilty.
Yes.
So we have a man here in your neck of the woods in Delaware who not only was it reported, he also confessed to it, and
mm-hmm.
he was found guilty,
mm-hmm.
and he's not, I mean, what's his punishment? He gets probation. I don't understand that. Are you guys getting news about this that I do not have? Is there something that we haven't been told about this story?
Preface this by saying, you know, number one, you know, though I'm a native and you know fairly familiar with local politics, I'm not part of the local political. Machine, as it were. So, I'm strictly giving an outsider's perspective. And then,
mm-hmm.
secondly, also bear in mind that, and one of the things to know is that Delaware is a very small state. It's almost like a small city, it has a small town feel throughout because of its small size. So there's a lot of overlap with folks knowing each other, political maneuvering, and all of that sort of thing.
Okay.
In this case, my understanding, you know, from my reading and from what I'm aware of is that the judge was considered generally fair in terms of aside from this, generally fair in her decisions, not seeming to favor any particular, not favoring prosecution or defendants in on cases, and. This particular instance, though, I think becomes national attention for two reasons, at least from my reading of it. And, you know, one is that the person involved is a DuPont heir, And DuPont, for those that don't know Delaware, DuPont, folks I'm sure have probably heard of them. They invented nylon. They started in the mid-1800s creating black powder for the Civil War and all of those things, and basically for well over a century they've been the major political force in Delaware. I think it's less true today as some of their fortunes have declined, but it's still they're still almost the sort of reigning family slash business of Delaware, and potentially in terms of influence. And this particular gentleman, the perpetrator, is a direct a grandson of one of the significant guiders of the DuPont Company, that. You know, certainly brings, you know, in addition to just simply being wealthy, which, you know, he is because of his inheritance as a family fortune, he's also in the most well-connected, part of the most well-connected family in Delaware with a history of basically as goes DuPont, so goes Delaware. So okay. I think that's, locally, that's one issue that jumps out at folks in you know finding out about the decision. The second thing is the judge's one set of comments, which and ultimately her decision to give probation. From what I've read, her discretion in giving probation is not beyond the bounds of what discretion she has as a judge in that case, but the comments in her decision, this particular comment, in that she made the decision for probation because she didn't think the prisoner or the accused would fare well. That was actually her words in prison. Mm-hmm. Is the second piece of what makes this so controversial. One big unknown is, and one thing that folks are speculating about is, was that decision and those comments influenced simply by her perhaps personal bias, impressions towards someone who was, you know, prominent and wealthy, you know, or the greater suspicion, the more conspiracy-minded, you know, was it because there was influence exerted? And I don't think there's any way that we can know that right now. But I think that's the groundwork of why we are where we are with the news about it.
Okay. And has there ever been a case like this before with, you know, the wealthy, some wealthy person or something doing something egregious? And is this typical in Delaware to have some sort of brouhaha over a sentencing, a judge's sentence?
It really, granted I'm not a legal scholar, but I've followed, you know, Delaware politics and news for many years. Nothing at that level necessarily stands out. I mean, we've had other DuPont heirs, another DuPont, more distant DuPont heir who was, I believe, convicted of murder, and received, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, significant sentencing. We had, a well-connected developer, Tom Capano, who made some national headlines in that he killed his mistress and was very politically connected, very wealthy. The family was a family of developers, and he, too, received a significant, I believe, a life sentence, if not short of that. So other significant, you know, that I'm aware of, prominent Delaware persons, just off the top of my head, have not necessarily been seen as gotten a light touch. I don't know if the difference is because those were murder cases and this is sexual assault.
Yeah. Huh. The other interesting thing about this is that this judge, Judge Jan Juergen, supposedly has a reputation for being kind of a tough sentencing judge.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's been the general impression, and so it does stand out as an anomaly that, you know, in this particular case, which all the more heightens, well, why differently in this case, and it certainly rouses people's sense of injustice, you know, in the phrasing she used in her sentencing, that he wouldn't fare well when you contrast that to what he confessed to and was convicted of.
Okay. So let's talk about this little 3-year-old girl. It is difficult for a child, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just going to say something that I believe. It is very difficult for a child who has been sexually abused to grow up without a lot of difficulty in adjusting to a normal adult life, a normal sex life, a normal everything life. Is that true?
All of that is true. There increases the likelihood of poor relationships as a teen going into adulthood. It increases the likelihood of substance use. It increases the likelihood of increases the likelihood of being raped as an adult. All of that to say that it's not necessarily fait accompli as a given that with good proper family and friend support to the little girl and counseling, these negative factors can be mitigated and they can be overcome. But there's a myriad of factors that have to go well for that to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So this child has her work cut out for her to try and have as normal a life as possible after this experience. My other question is okay, if this guy is on probation, and I haven't been able to find this out, maybe you know this, does this mean he's free to go back home? Is he free to see his child?
My understanding is that no, I believe I'm remembering correctly that he does have a no contact with children order in place. And
we can feel confident that a man who has already broken the law to this extent and in this egregious way will follow a protective order, right?
I do get the sarcasm.
Okay, all right.
And yeah, there's certainly. I think it's probably less likely because of the amount of knowledge and focus around him and his own daughter that if he were to ultimately decide to break that restriction, it would probably be with a new child, someone that he comes in contact with through some other means.
Isn't it that it's kind of like speeding. How often do you break the speed limit in your car, and how often are you caught? You know,
Unfortunately, the success rate of enough treatment such that especially a sexual predator of, and I really can't think of a different word for his actions given her age, given their the close familiar relationship, the likelihood that they won't reoffend is very low. We just haven't found consistently effective treatment. Now, I cannot say. I'm not saying that will be the case for him. I have no way of knowing. But
as a general rule, these guys don't just pick on one particular child.
They
usually offend a number of ways, a number of times, and I would think that with basically getting a little slap on the wrist for assaulting his own child, what incentive does he have to stay within the law? You know, I mean, he has not really received any negative response to his behavior. Other than negative publicity, but it doesn't sound like that matters too much to him.
I'd also add in an additional piece. I don't know if you're aware, but one of the things that brought this whole kind of decision back to light is that his ex-wife filed a civil suit. And as part of the discovery, I'm not sure exactly how it came to light, but of course he had been on probation from the original conviction, and as part of his probation, apparently he was required to undergo polygraph tests on a regular basis. It's one of the ways that probation for sexual offenders used to try and check, gauge, monitor whether the person is staying away from children and not reoffending. And
let me interrupt right here. Aren't pedophiles noted for being able to pass polygraph tests?
Some are. There's a subset of pedophiles that, number one, may be more sociopathic, meaning that they don't have a lot of remorse and therefore are not going to show the extreme emotions when confronted on a polygraph. Then secondly, there's also the factor that others that may not have sociopathy, but really truly believe that they are not harming the child, that they have done nothing wrong. And so, that it is easier for them to not show up if they're not being truthful on a polygraph. But in this case, and where I was going with this particular case, is that it was learned that in the course of this polygraph examinations, subsequent after the trial and on probation, that he also admitted to sexually assaulting his 3-year-old son.
Oof.
And that's what the discovery of that and the filing of the civil suit by his ex-wife is what brought that bit of information. And to this point, no charges or follow-up that I'm aware of has been done to that admission on his part.
Yeah.
So when you have a perpetrator who is perpetrates against both girls and boys, it's someone that's probably strictly motivated by prepubescent children, which often increases the likelihood that they will reoffend, given the sort of indiscriminateness of their preferences and tendencies.
Yeah, I'm going to toss out our phone number one more time. It is 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. I'd really, really like it if you called in and joined our conversation. there is an editorial in Delaware Times. What's the name of the publication? Delaware.
It's Delaware News Journal.
Delaware News Journal, and it was written by a member of the Bar Association for Delaware, and he says that the article, the publicity, was misleading, and that the article indicates that this reflects the judge's own personal feelings, and he says that's speculative and misleading. The article does not tell the reader that the notation actually appears in a section of the sentencing form headed notes, where a judge normally lists comments made at the hearing by prosecutors and defense counsel. So what he's saying is that, first of all, that he will not fare well in prison probably isn't the judge's quote, even though it's been reported that way, that the judge just writes it down on a piece of paper when she finds, you know, she's taking notes on what the lawyers are saying. So he contends that that's the situation. And he said that the judge imposed a sentence of 8 years in prison, suspended in favor of 8 years probation with strict conditions. The conditions included the completion of a rigorous residential and outpatient treatment program for sex offenders. Well, those programs have very, very mixed results.
Yes, I think mixed is probably a kind description.
Yeah, yeah, it's very hard. Usually, and what I know about this is that you send a domestic violence offender to treatment, you send a sex offender to treatment, and what they do is they learn how to expand their vocabulary, and that's about it. They learn more tricks of the trade, if you will. That's what I see. She also ordered close monitoring during the entire probation with zero tolerance for violation, which would reinstate the prison sentence. No contact with children, including his own, and that this defendant has completed the sex offender program and has spent more than 5 years on intensively monitored probation under the supervision of Delaware's highly trained probation and parole office with no violations of parole. Now, I'm a little confused by that. You know, he was found guilty of this and has been on probation for 5 years. I mean, and this indicates that he might have done this before. So that's confusing to me.
Could you clarify which part is confusing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm under the impression that this is the first time he was caught. But then this, in this opinion letter to the editor, this lawyer says that, I guess he's making a case that probation and treatment should be okay, because he says this guy has been on probation for 5 years, and he's completed the sex offender program. He's completed the sex offender program and has spent more than 5 years on intensively monitored probation under the supervision of Delaware's highly trained blah, blah, blah. So I don't know whether he just mixed up his tenses, but it sounds to me like this guy's done this before.
I think that if I'm recollecting correctly, because you're speaking about the information that came out about the son.
Ah.
Is that... Okay. Is that where you're?
I don't know. It's not clear in this letter to the editor. I mean, this lawyer is making a case for Judge Juergen, saying, mm-hmm. you know, that first of all, she probably didn't make that whole comment, and secondly of all, you know, that yeah, he might have gotten probation, but he has all these really really heavy duty conditions on the probation. I noticed that, you know, wearing an ankle bracelet, for example, which a lot of states do with sex offenders. Isn't one of those extensive, conditions of mm-hmm. probation. So I don't know whether Delaware does not do that or whether they just chose not to do that in this case, which tells me that he's not as closely monitored as this writer would like us to believe.
So you're kind of questioning the accuracy of whether, you know, the assertion that, you know, he's been basically a model probationer because...
Yes.
you're saying,
yeah.
you know, perhaps he's not
because
been
he
monitored
hasn't been caught
closely
doing
enough.
Anything again. Yeah.
Right. You know, and certainly that's all, you know, no probation is foolproof, you know, especially, you know, as, you know, it goes back around to, toward the notoriously difficult task of trying to eradicate, cure, whatever word you want to use, the compulsions, the,
yes.
This, you know, the brain chemistry. They're not, there's no one has a clear, there's no clear science as to, you know, whether there's any one thing that drives the tendencies toward pedophilia. So, the treatment therefore is questionable, you know, in terms of its results.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear you're saying that this, you know, there could be a likelihood that they just missed something. You know, it's certainly possible. It's, you know, again, cannot make that assertion because we don't know, but we can certainly be concerned.
Yeah. And another question that I had was, what about all these children that he's exposed to? Now, supposedly, he has a protection order against other children, but how do you not find children in this world? You know, I mean, they're around us. They're with us.
Right.
They're part of humanity. So how can you reasonably assume that this guy will not be around any children? And
that,
there's a lot
I mean,
of really
that,
stupid parents out there, I must say.
I think there are a lot of overstressed, overworked, undereducated, at least in terms of potential dangers, not necessarily undereducated in scholastic terms, but that, you know, there's a lot of single parents, not to disparage them. I mean, sexual assault happens
makes it
to
harder.
Children.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you know, less opportunity for supervision, more likelihood to be receptive to someone who's, you know, willing to help out and say, hey, babysit, you know, for me, you know, and occasionally when I, you know, as a parent, when I need to go and do something that, you know, I can't take my child along. So, you know, those opportunities are certainly there. I mean, the sex offender registration helps somewhat, but you're right. It's not foolproof.
Yeah, and when I say stupid, I don't mean what you're describing. I mean some of the parents I know who, for example, know that grandma's new husband has spent time in jail for being a sex offender, for raping a child, and yet they will let grandma and step-grandpa babysit their children.
Yeah, that's a different kind of, that's a different level of... I would probably just describe it as either one, as either willful ignorance, because it's such societally, it's such a difficult issue to confront, to believe that it's true. Many times the offender, they're released, they can be charming, they can be gregarious, and they can also give a version of events that, you know, while they ended up in jail, you know, what was said that happened and they got convicted on didn't really happen. And people are just so reluctant to look at it or believe that it could have happened and are willing to turn a blind eye rather than face the more difficult truth about the nature of some folks. The other possibility... The other possibility, too, is that parents that do that, there's a high likelihood that, and there's a definite statistical correlation that they themselves may have been sexually abused as a child and are more, they can go one of two ways. They can go where they're hypervigilant with their own children about strangers, or they can go the other way where their sense of boundaries and safety are kind of permanently distorted. And are frequently the children of women and men, but women that have been sexually abused are often more likely to be sexually abused themselves because of the survivor never truly learns, you know, learns to be able to set appropriate boundaries, or to, you know, or to fully overcome their feelings of guilt and maybe, you know, compliance, that they feel like somehow they, you know, they deserved it, and then that leads to,
well,
to far more lax.
And perpetrators use a grooming process. They
sure.
basically brainwash their victim before they ever put a hand on them. So,
sure.
you know, I mean, if, you know, oh, this is not wrong. You know, society is wrong. They're saying that this is wrong, but actually, you know, I'm helping you. A father has an obligation to make sure his daughter's experienced before she goes out in the world. I mean, they use all sorts of techniques to convince the person, the victim especially, that it's okay. It's okay. You know,
sure.
there's nothing wrong with it.
And children naturally crave attention, and especially from people they're close to, people they feel, you know, love, whether it's parents or close friends of the family or relatives. And so for them it's a mixed bag, because, you know, oftentimes the predators will target children who aren't getting a lot of attention, and so now
yeah.
suddenly they are, and that's where the victim then feels complicit, because they sought out the attention, they sought out the
yeah.
you know, the company, and then feel like what it ultimately happened was because they, you know, they continued to seek out the relationship, and that's one of the most insidious ways that it can damage someone, and one of the hardest ones for a survivor to overcome. And the good news is
well,
that
I want to go back
can.
A little bit when we were talking about parents, because I think, you know, you were mentioning this willful ignorance, which I really like that phrase. Several years ago, my husband was in a profession, the medical profession, and we had a group of people. We were at a party with a group of people and a group of his cohorts, and one of the people from his profession, from his specialty, had just been convicted in two separate counties. One county he had his office, the other county he had his home. And in two separate counties, he had been convicted of sexually assaulting his 15-year-old daughter. Now, at the party, these people were mulling this around. They were saying, well, there's something wrong with that. You know, no, he's such a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me want to tear my hair out. Of course he's a nice guy, he's, you know, to you, you know.
Right.
You know?
And
you know, yeah, I mean,
charming and gregarious is more
of course.
You know, is
yeah.
more likely
good neighbor.
To be part of the personality. There's the loner that's more of the sociopathic type that you know, it would be, you know, you wouldn't say that about
no.
and they're more
but most
likely,
of them aren't that way.
Yeah,
but
that's a lower percentage.
In this discussion, I was explaining, you know, what I knew about these situations, and that, yeah, of course he seems like a nice guy, blah, blah, blah. But then somebody said to me, well, that girl never liked him. There's something wrong
sure.
with this. And I thought, what they're saying is the girl did this just because she didn't like him. They're not saying she didn't like him because he hurt her. You know, he did this to her, and it was like,
right.
how can you not make this connection? You know, it's like that old study about, you know, smoking causes wrinkles. Really? You know, you know, that's a little bit too of a direct correlation. You know, there's too many missing factors there. The girl didn't like him, and so their assumption was that she just did this to be mean to him.
And again,
and for me.
Oh, I'm sorry, you go ahead.
Yeah, that willful ignorance that you're talking about, they couldn't reconcile what he had done and what he had been found guilty of in not just one county but in two counties. And so they just were willing to ignore this poor victim.
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the things that we know fairly well from treatment and research and sociological circumstances is that because of the shame and humiliation and societal taboo of reporting, you know, this kind of thing. It's a minute, minuscule, very small, less than, it's like 0.0-something percentage points of where we have evidence that, you know, children or teens actually report falsely that, you know, something has happened when it hasn't. That the negative consequences are so great that but unfortunately for many people, they, you know, it again, for that willful ignorance, it gives them in their mind and out, well, you know, this was made up. She sometimes in custody disputes and so forth, it comes out that way. But it's really, it's a red herring. It bears very little resemblance to what actually happens. And I would point to two, you know, somewhat recent, well-known national circumstances where where you see that sort of denial of reality. I'm thinking of the Sandusky case and the continuing support of his wife that, you know, despite the mounds of evidence and despite her, you know, her close knowledge of his activities, that she continues to support him and believe his innocence. The other being the recent letter by, and I forget her name, but she was a child of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, who wrote an open letter to the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a lot of negative backlash, both in social media and some popular media, as to, yeah, you know, why are you doing this, you know, questioning her motives, et cetera.
Think her brother, one of her brothers said, you know, one of her brothers supported her, the other brother supported Woody Allen. I mean, it's,
yeah,
like even within the family, this girl is getting negative responses.
The you can't underestimate the impact of the family desire to protect even you know, suspected perpetrators. It's something I think that goes almost back to tribal or clannish our evolutionary kind of biological imperative, not to mention fear of embarrassment and shame. As you pointed out earlier, that encourages, that relatives in a family will encourage someone who was perpetrated against or just is aware of it to still go to family functions, go to reunions, go to, you know, parties, mm-hmm, with those people, just to so as not to upset the kind of the family norm. I think it might have been Freud or it might have been Jung, I forget which, that said a family is a unit that it's designed to protect its most wounded member. And that always sort of comes into my mind when I think about that.
That's interesting. I have not heard that before, but a lot of us have lived that kind of dynamic, yeah. Wow. I'm going to have to write that down. So let's talk about this little 3-year-old. What's down the road for her?
Well, I mean, a lot of it, fortunately and unfortunately, a lot of it is going to be, a lot of it's going to have depended on things that have already happened. Crucial to, to getting a good start towards a healthy, for a survivor to become healthy is, how was she originally received? How was she believed immediately? Was she blamed? Were there, you know, basically her, you know, that's a, for any survivor, their initial disclosure, especially if that disclosure is to another trusted family member, how is that received? The degree to which it's received with respect and openness and willingness to hear and feelings of remorse for what happened to them. And I'm not talking about the perpetrator, but I'm talking about other trusted family members. Whoever gets that first disclosure is in a key position to improve the likelihood of future mental health. for that child by being open, accepting, trusting. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to immediately decide that, you know, to convict the person that they're disclosing, but to believe them in the moment, in their story, especially a child that young, because it's almost inconceivable that the child is fabricating something. And
yeah, at age three, so they don't really know. They don't understand sex. They don't know that whole thing. So if they talk about something like that happening, they had to have gotten it from somewhere. And they don't, as far as I know, they don't teach sex ed to three-year-olds. I mean,
I mean, it's you know, there's a small incidence, but you can't go wrong by being empathetic, being open and being accepting of what they're saying as a starting point. Don't, you know, you don't want to be playing detective at the get-go. You want to let, you know, trained counselors and special victims units and those sorts of things figure it out. You want to be, you know, and you want to be encouraging. You don't want to express shock or extreme emotions, because that can shut the child down. But then going forward, continued good family support, counseling is absolutely essential. Continuing to find to work on self-esteem issues, to find help the child find good activities that will build self-esteem, sports, music, the arts, 4-H, whatever. But what's one of the key things is rebuilding self-esteem, and ultimately, it's the quality of the support and attention and care that they get from family, friends, and from professionals that could mitigate some of the awful effects of the assault on the survivor and on the little girl in this case.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, in any kind of a trauma experienced by a child, if they share it with you, whether you're a parent or a friend, you got to remember it's about them. It's not about
right.
you and, you know, the horror that you might feel or the empathy that you might feel or the shock or whatever. It's about that child. And you have to focus on what will help that child. And you might feel rage, but is rage going to help your child, you know?
Right, exactly. That's an excellent point, because frequently that perpetrator is known to the child and maybe the child thought fondly of them, maybe loved them, especially if they're a close family member. So, you know, they're going to have frequently mixed feelings when they report. You know, that's part of the reason why it's so hard, is they feel guilt because they have good feelings about the person as well as bad. So, yes, your reaction shouldn't, you know, include a lot of condemnation of the person. Simply, you know, expressing, you know, sorrow that it happened, reminding them that they, you know, that they weren't responsible for this person doing something that they shouldn't have, and, you know, and encouraging them to speak to, you know, the folks, the appropriate folks as it moves forward, and to just tell the truth, and again, keeping a very warm, supportive, but non-reactive. Kind of tone, despite the fact that you may want to go and rip the, you know, person's head off that you've now been told.
You know, that's
counterproductive to the child at that point.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we have to focus that this is about the child. This is about the victim. And I can't help but, I understand the three-year-old daughter is no longer three. She's like 12 now. Is that?
I think that might be right. Yes.
Yeah, so she has been aware probably of all these court proceedings. Do you think that it will have an impact on her recovery, if that's the appropriate word to use, knowing that this guy basically got his hand slapped?
I think that that's something that will be a something she will be continuing to come to terms with. Given the age that it happened and given the age she is now, she has traveled through at least two and maybe three developmental stages. And with each developmental stage, a child's cognition abilities, the way they see the world, their judgments will change. And so that's why the ongoing counseling and support in whatever ways is crucial, because as she goes through the different developmental phases cognitively, she will have different perspectives and different views about what happened and how she may have felt about it at age 5 is going to be different than how she felt about it at age 8 and then again at age 12.
Before we started this conversation, I mentioned that I had a colleague who was abused by her father growing up, started very young, and I didn't know the issue until she was well into her 40s. And she was just very matter-of-fact about it, my father abused me and it wasn't the end of the world kind of thing. And I just looked at her and went, oh, I am so sorry,
Mm-hmm.
And she immediately started to cry. And I think that she was ready to face the trauma that experience caused for her instead of just pushing it away. And she was mm-hmm. in her mid-40s before that hit her.
That's also not uncommon and not surprising that one of the common ways, especially young victims, cope is by dissociating, which basically means kind of compartmentalizing in their brain what's happening to them and kind of shutting it off to the side so that they can survive through the actions. And sometimes that compartmentalizing doesn't get on it's just too scary for them to face, and it doesn't get unlocked even with counseling until 5 years, 10 years, 15, 40, that 40 years later it really it can just sort of stay tucked away. Now the effects are still can still be very very harmful. They may have a series of relationships that don't go well and they can't figure out why. They may turn to substances. They may experience general anxiety and not know why. All of those things until they unlock it, and for some, it just has to be at whatever time that they are personally able to fully admit the trauma that they basically put aside in a box and decided not to open that box ever until
it hurts too much.
Exactly,
yeah.
And for many, it feels like to do so would be death in some way, especially if it's a primary caregiver that's the person who assaulted, because that primary caregiver was basically had life and death control over a young child. And so, it can be as big as life and death.
Huge issue. When a child is assaulted, is it worse if it's that parent or the parent figure than it would be if it were a stranger?
Generally speaking, it does tend to be more psychologically scarring. The closer the relationship, it depends. I mean, if it's
sure.
If it's a stepfather that's in the picture, but the relationship has been distant, it all has to do with how much trust and love and identification the child has with the person, and obviously the parents or generally the primary. But you could have an equally traumatic response for a beloved grandfather who, let's say, lives with the family, and is a huge part of their life. But generally speaking, you're going to have a higher likelihood that level of trust, intimacy, etc., is going to be found in, you know, if a father is present in the home, or a mother, there are instances of female perpetrated incest, although they're significantly lower, or at least lower reported.
And I would just like to throw out, the idea of getting some sort of professional counseling is huge, because folks, you know, that are trained in what this child will likely need to deal with, folks that, you know, when it happens to you or your loved one, that's probably only the first or maybe second time you've ever seen such a situation. You're not going to have the resources to know exactly what this person needs, this victim needs. I would suggest, though, that you very carefully choose the psychologist or counselor that you go to deal with this. Maybe calling your local rape crisis center would be a good start.
Yes.
But not all therapists work well with this kind of a situation. And if you get a therapist who's not experienced, who's not good at these issues, in my opinion, you may as well not even bother going.
I think your advice is well taken. That yes, you definitely should shop for someone that is skilled, experienced, and can give you credentials to that effect. Because you're right. Basically, the process is a process of unpacking trauma, and skilled therapists give the survivor tools to unpack that trauma in a way that they can handle a bit at a time, and also tools to kind of put that, kind of, if I keep with that metaphor, close that box up from between sessions, so that the person doesn't get overwhelmed and re-traumatized, re-stimulated. So yes, you definitely want someone that's skilled in that area, and certainly local rape crisis agencies can direct you if they don't provide those services themselves, to look for that. And one other thing,
sure.
And I know we're about close to close, but one other thing to bear in mind is that sometimes there is a significant prevalence of therapists who became therapists who are survivors, and part of the question is did they sufficiently work through their own trauma? Because otherwise that will interfere with their ability to work with someone else's.
Sure. Very good. Very good points. Before we wrap up here, I just want to I'm on the RAINN website, RAINN, which is a rape resource organization nationally, and they throw out a few statistics on rapists and sexual assault perpetrators. The average age of a rapist is 31, 52% are white, 22% of imprisoned rapists report that they are married, and in 1 in 3 sexual assaults, the perpetrator was drunk. 11% of rapes used weapons. Yeah.
There's a high correlation between substance use because substance use alters your judgments, your boundaries, your barriers, and can increase likelihood that you would do something.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you find yourself, unfortunately, in a situation where you need to get help, either for yourself or a child, and you don't have to be a parent to give some phone numbers or to be there for that child, okay? RAINN is a very good place to start. It is the National Sexual Assault Hotline is 1-800-656-HOPE. 1-800-656-HOPE. And they will hook you up with some agencies or services in your area. They will give you some resources that you can reach out for. I am moved. I have to say I'm highly moved by our talk today, and I really appreciate your being with us. I really think that you were articulate and provided some really good information for us today. Thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to have been of some help, and I echo your strong recommendation that if you know somebody that needs help, have them call the national hotline, and, you know, don't wait.
Yep. And join us next week. We're going to be talking about technology and abuse, in other words, stalking and cyber stalking, that kind of thing. So thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week.